Hi, I'm Aaron Harmon.
And I'm Diane Cox. Welcome to Inside Out Quality.
Both Diane and I build and implement quality systems in the biotech and medical device industry. But we often get asked, is this really necessary? How do we know if we are doing too much too early? Or do we even need a quality system?
Our goal is to explore questions like these through real-life events and experiences shared by our guests from various regulated industries. We will show you why quality is not just about compliance and how, when it's done right, it can help your product and company improve lives and make a difference.
On February 24th, 2009, a Taurus XL rocket launched from Vandenberg Air Force Base in California, carrying NASA's Orbiting Carbon Observatory, a satellite to help track the climate. The rocket got to the point of deploying its satellite when a key part, the frangible joint, failed to work as designed, which caused the rocket's fairing not to open. The satellite mission was lost. An investigation ensued, root causes believed to be found, and after corrective actions, a second mission was undertaken. That was on March 4th, 2001, and again, a Taurus rocket lifted off to space, this time carrying NASA's Glory Scientific satellite. It too ended in failure as the same joint failed to operate. In total, over $700 million was lost, not to mention the value from scientific data and the blow to morale of the teams at NASA because of this failed joint. When something goes awry, investigations occur. Root causes are determined, and in this case, the root cause took years to solve. How it was solved is better told by one of the men who led the case, resulting in a supplier paying $46 million in fines and restitution. That being said, with us is Special Agent Wade Krieger with NASA's Office of Inspector General. Welcome to the show, Wade.
Hi, glad to be here. First of all, I'd like to thank you and Diane for giving me the opportunity to speak to your audience today. It's truly an honor.
Yeah, so we'd love to dive into this story and the work you did to help figure out what was going on in the first place with these rockets. But before we get there, the first question is, how did you get into law enforcement? What drew you in, and when did you start working for NASA?
You know, I don't remember ever really focusing on being a policeman when I was a kid, which was a long time ago, by the way, back in the 1970s. But I used to love Star Trek, and I also watched like every single James Bond movie ever made with my dad. So when I got a little older, I decided I wanted to go into the Air Force, maybe because that was probably about as close to the Starfleet Academy as I was ever going to get. But most likely it was just a good way to get away from home and have a little adventure. So I decided that I wanted to be a fighter pilot. But while I was in the Air Force ROTC program at Memphis State University back in the 80s, Top Gun came out. And well, all of a sudden, everybody wanted to be a fighter pilot. So it became really, really competitive, and I didn't quite make the cut. Fortunately for me, the Commandant of Cadets at the ROTC unit where I was exposed me to something called the Air Force Office of Special Investigations. Most people just call that OSI. And I was almost instantly hooked on their mission when I heard about it. So OSI does basically the same thing as the FBI. They perform federal law enforcement duties, except they do it exclusively for the Air Force. I was lucky enough out of college to be picked up by OSI as a brand new second lieutenant in the Air Force. And that's where I got my initial training as a criminal investigator. And after I spent about 10 years or so on active duty, I got married, I separated from the Air Force, and then I was hired by the NASA OIG. I stayed in the Air Force for, I don't know, another 11 years or so as a reserve officer, which was part-time, you might say. And then I retired from the military in 2010. So I've been working for NASA OIG at Kennedy Space Center down here in Florida since about the year 2000.
Can you tell us about the role that you have at the OIG at NASA?
Sure. There are over 60 different inspector general offices that support different agencies and departments all throughout the federal government. OIGs were first created in the federal government after the Inspector General Act of 1978 was passed by Congress. So the purpose of this act was to promote economy and efficiency and effectiveness throughout the government. And I think they wanted IGs to serve as kind of a watchdog against fraud, waste, abuse, and mismanagement in the government. Most IGs have a division that regularly conducts audits, which are generally aimed at making sure the agency follows its own rules and makes good choices when they spend our tax dollars. And OIGs also typically have an investigations division that functions as a federal law enforcement agency. So kind of like the FBI and OSI. So at NASA IG, that's where I work, in the Office of Investigations. So in the investigations office, our mission is to handle criminal, civil, and administrative investigations that involve NASA personnel, resources, contractors, or programs. The IG Act is public law, and part of that law gives investigators like me access to all of the records from the agency that we serve. We also have subpoena power for records that the government does not control or possess, and we can execute federal search and arrest warrants as well. So if an IG is doing its job well and functioning properly, I like to think of it like a good antivirus software package on your computer. If it's working right, it'll root out all the viruses on your machine and neutralize them, and it'll make your machine run quicker and better and more efficiently. And most of the time, you're not even going to know it's there. It runs in the background. So on our best days, when we're doing our jobs really well at the NASA IG, we help NASA to perform their mission more efficiently. We help them spend the taxpayer money that they get from Congress wisely. And we help them fly their mission safer. And also, occasionally, every now and then, we catch a few bad guys along the way.
Wait, it sounds like you also could have done well in QA. Talking about investigations and audits and helping things run without problems and efficiently. Like, that's very QA sounding. I like it.
Well, QA are... You guys are our cousins. We kind of do the same thing.
Yep, that's what I'm going to start introducing myself as. I'm an FBI cousin. OIG cousin.
I think that works. I think that works very well.
So the first rocket goes up and it fails to reach orbit. There's a second one that goes up and it fails. How did you hear about this? Like, is that like the news all across NASA? Was there a point where someone's like, get Wade on the phone now, page him? Bring him in. We need to investigate. Like, what'd that look like?
Actually, I remember hearing about the second one that failed, but it launched from California, not here at Cape Canaveral, where I am. And it was, you know, I was all the way across the country. So honestly, I didn't really pay that much attention to it at first. But later on, I was approached by this NASA metallurgist who had assisted my office on a few previous cases. Brilliant guy. This guy, I hold him in high esteem. He's personally responsible for teaching me probably 90% of what I know about metal. Anyway, this metallurgist had performed some tests on an aluminum frangible joint extrusion in his lab at Kennedy Space Center. And he was actually tasked to perform one type of tests, but because he's just a really thorough guy, he also performed some other basic tests on the aluminum's material properties. And some of those tests failed. So, which was a little bit alarming to him. So because he wasn't expecting that to happen. So he contacted me because he thought that bad aluminum like this might possibly have had something to do with the launch failures that had just happened. So upon hearing this, I also learned pretty quickly that the contracts for both of the failed missions were managed out of Kennedy Space Center, where I was, by NASA's Launch Services Program, and that these frangible joint extrusions that were used on both flights were in fact made by the same supplier, a company called SAPA Profiles that was located in Portland, Oregon. So in 2012, I teamed up with my partner on this case, a fantastic NASA OIG agent who's out in California, and we began investigating. And after we got going, there were several other agents and attorneys that joined the team, and they all ultimately played a big part in making this successful.
You're going to have to help me out, Wade. What's a frangible joint?
Okay. So, good question. So, a frangible joint is a part that is essentially made to break, because that's kind of what frangible means. It's supposed to crack apart at the right time and release the satellite so that it can go do its mission. So if you picture a rocket, there is something at the very top called a fairing, which is where the satellite rides until it gets to space. And I like to think of a frangible joint as like a zipper that holds the fairing together with the satellite inside until an explosive charge inside the frangible joint detonates. Okay, so that's a lot. So when that when this happens, that this rail that runs down both sides of the rocket splits open, cracks open, picture like a clamshell, two halves kind of breaking open, and then that allows the satellite to separate from the rocket and go out into space and do science.
Got it. That makes sense. Thank you so much. Okay. So can you walk us through the investigation process? I guess both how NASA normally investigates these issues and then also how this particular situation was investigated.
So I guess the first place to start is with MIBs, Mishap Investigations Boards. Anytime there's a major accident or a failure like the ones we're talking about, NASA's standard procedure is to convene a mishap investigations board to try and figure out what happened. So in this case, there was an MIB for T8 and another one for T9.
Could you explain the T8 and T9?
The first mission that failed in February of 2011 was launched on the eighth Taurus rocket that the launch service provider launch. So the shorthand for that is we just call it T8 for short. And the second mission that failed was the ninth mission. So we call that one T9. So you'll hear me say, you know, if I refer to the missions as T8 and T9, that's what I mean. Sorry about that. So back to MIBs. So an MIB, NASA convenes a board and they reach out and they cherry pick some of their best and brightest engineers and technicians from a variety of different disciplines to look at all of, in this case, they were looking at all of the flight data, the telemetry, the modal analysis, and all the readings that they got from the launch and everything they knew about the launch to try and figure out the technical reason why it failed. So after both boards spent several months trying to, reviewing this data, and neither board could determine the root cause of the failure. Now, the second board found that both failures happened for the same reason. They found that because a single frangible joint side rail failed to completely break on one side at the top of each rocket. So subsequently, the fairings didn't open and the satellites, never separated from the rockets. And the whole thing just kind of lawn darted over and down into the Pacific Ocean. So both boards concluded that the frangible joint was likely the problem. And they knew the frangible joint failed. They just couldn't say for sure why it failed. So therefore, they really couldn't find the root cause.
These fairings with the satellites are in the Pacific Ocean somewhere. How did they come to the conclusion that it was the frangible joint that didn't break apart?
Well, they had instruments on board on the rockets that that monitored the systems as the rocket is traveling up into the stratosphere to as each stage breaks off, there are systems that monitor that. And so they were able to pinpoint that was actually and this gets a little over my head, technically speaking, but there was like a 3 megahertz spike in some of the modal analysis, which is the vibrations that are measured when the rocket is traveling up, that occurred almost exactly the same time in both flights. The flight paths were identical. Both rockets launched from the same launch pad. And so the mishap investigations boards were able to determine that the frangible joints did not function based on the flight data. But only on one side, which is actually ends up being fairly important.
It impresses me when people can kind of plan ahead for if something happens, how are they going to be able to sort it out later? And some of those details that go into it's pretty incredible.
It's a complicated thing. And it's actually, I'm not qualified to speak with any degree of expertise on that part of the case. That's why I depended heavily on the launch services people to do their jobs. And they did it very well. Analyzing the data that they had and telling me what they could say for sure and what they couldn't say for sure and that kind of thing.
Yeah. Good investigations are teamwork. Like,
absolutely.
You can't do them alone.
Absolutely. I wholeheartedly agree with that. Okay. So going back to our case, the IG case, in 2012, after I opened it, I began talking with a couple of really brilliant launch services program engineers about the aluminum that had failed in the metallurgist lab. Ultimately, this dialogue led LSP to start their own technical investigation, which kind of took on a life of its own and picked up where the MIBs left off. And their goal was to be able to say for sure what the root cause of these failures was. They had a business reason to know that, because they didn't want it to happen again because of, you know, the money and man hours lost and the grief that losing two missions caused them. So MIBs are normal in these types of situations, but this third follow-on technical investigation was a little unusual, I guess because the MIBs were not able to find the root cause and it happened twice. So their investigation went on for several years during the same time frame, at the same time as our IG investigation. It was a separate and independent effort from ours, but there was a regular mutual exchange of information that I think was very healthy for both investigations. So, you know, looking back on it, I don't really believe that either of our organizations could have solved this case without the other. The NASA IG's office, you know, we obviously lacked the technical expertise to ever find the root cause of a rocket crash. I mean, that's just not what we do. But LSP did not really have the ability to obtain some of the information that we uncovered through subpoenas and interviews. And as it turned out, some of the technical data that we got from subpoenas that we gave to several different companies that were involved in making the T8 and T9 frangible joints, some of that information turned out to be absolutely critical to LSP being able to make the conclusions that they did with regards to the failure.
When you were subpoenaing, getting that data in, I think you brought a different set of eyes to the investigation, where it's easy to rule out the frangible joint the specifications, mm-hmm. because you would see the passing data and say, yep, it passed. It's good mm-hmm. enough. You have a metallurgist that kind of clues in something's going wrong and he's seeing something different. Mm-hmm. And so I guess, I don't know if there's much of a question in this, but more of a, you know, I just thought it was when you had originally mentioned to me that you were able to see that, hey, maybe something is suspicious going on here. Let's get a subpoena to get that data versus someone saying, yeah, we checked their specs and it passed. It was good. We can rule it out.
So along those lines, and I think that MIBs, and I was planning on touching on this a little later, but I think MIBs are excellent at doing what they are charged with doing, which is to find technical solutions to failures, right? But those boards, as successful as they have been in the past and as good of work as they do, I think in these two cases, they may not have been consciously considering the possibility that someone was committing fraud in this case and may not have been doing what they were supposed to do. So there may have been a blind spot there. And it's not a criticism. It's just each of us approach a problem with, we bring to the table the things that are in each of our backgrounds. You know, like I do not think like an engineer, although after working for 7 years with these guys, I've learned how they think. And it's a very good tool for someone in my job to have. So I don't know if that helps.
So I have a bit of a confession to make. Uh-huh. This is your first time meeting Diane, but Diane has known about you actually for quite a while.
Yeah. Aaron talks very highly of you, Wade.
well, thank you.
Yep. When we first talked, it was in January, and I had seen the press release and I had reached out to NASA and they ultimately ended up connecting you and I. Diane and I were in the Minneapolis area doing some audits on suppliers ourselves, and you had called. So I made Diane sit with me in a car in a parking lot for about 20 minutes while we talked. And then, then afterwards I told her that you were my new BFF. So that's been kind of like the, if I tell Diane, I'm talking to my BFF, she knows it's you.
I know. Yep, exactly.
Oh, well, that's very flattering. I can tell you that I know a number of people in quality assurance, and I'll go back to my cousin's analogy, because quality assurance people make my job so much easier if they're doing their job well. So the mm-hmm. people that really care and they pay attention and they take to heart what they're there to do, they are godsend to people in my line of work. So yeah, the respect is mutual. My hat's off to you guys for what you do.
Very good.
And so, speaking of respect and kind of the coolness of the jobs that we have, you're also at NASA. And when I tell people, I'm speaking to this special agent from NASA, it's pretty cool because you guys have some really cool people on your team. You work with a bunch of rocket scientists. What are they like to work with?
Oh, wow. They are, it was such a great privilege for me to have worked with the launch services engineers that I got to work with. They're truly remarkable people, and they're patient, because it takes a special type of brilliance to be able to accurately dumb down rocket scientists so that a guy like me can follow it. So my hat is off to them, and they took the time to, when I wasn't tracking, they took the time to lay it out for me in small pieces, and they taught me so much. So it was my privilege.
Can you tell us briefly what NASA's conclusions were on why the failures happened?
Sure. I'll give it a whirl. LSP's investigation agreed with the T9 MIB that a single frangible joint side rail near the top of each rocket failed to break. But they went a little further, and they determined that the rail didn't break as it was supposed to because of a combination of three factors. The first one was thick fracture ligaments on the frangible joint extrusions. The second one was charge holder contraction due to temperature. And the third one was discrepant material properties of the frangible joint extrusions. Now, I probably don't have time to explain to you what those first two things mean, what they are, the thick fracture ligaments and charge holder contraction. But if anyone is truly interested in that stuff, there's a pretty detailed description contained in NASA's technical summary of their investigation, which NASA released publicly last year. So if you do Google searches on these mishaps, you will come across a NASA press release with a summary hyperlinked. But the important thing to know is that these first two factors could not have caused the joint to fail all by themselves. NASA had enough data to calculate almost exactly how much of these factors eroded the safety margin, which was designed into the frangible joints. And those two things combined could not have caused it to fail. So there had to be a third factor. And NASA's technical investigation concluded that the third factor was discrepant material properties in the aluminum extrusions that were, part of those frangible joints. Now, the aluminum supplier, Sapa Profiles, they dispute NASA's technical findings. They do not agree that the aluminum extrusions made in their plant caused these missions to fail. And they're certainly entitled to make that argument. However, if the rockets had not failed, we would not have discovered that SAPA was engaged routinely in altering mechanical property test results on their aluminum for almost two decades.
So how long did it take to get to the point where you were like, aha, we now know why these two rockets had failed?
It took a really, really long time because when NASA OIG figured out that there were test results being changed, that still didn't, there was a whole nother, the NASA technical investigation was exhaustive. And a frangible joint, as I described it, the kind of the way it works is fairly simple. But there's a whole lot of complex things that go on when a frangible joint detonates. And so NASA, they looked at each component of the frangible joint in depth, and they looked at the suppliers of each of the parts, and they looked at all of the data, and it was really an exhausted process. So it took years before they were able to conclusively make the conclusion that they did. I can just leave it there probably.
Now we'll take a quick break to hear from one of our sponsors.
Today's startups become tomorrow's growth engines. In South Dakota, we're entering a new stage of expansion for our biotech industry, and you'll want to be part of it. Hi, I'm Joni Johnson, Executive Director of South Dakota Biotech. We're the state affiliate of the International Bio Organization, and we're proud to be leading a state that's driving innovation to feed, fuel, and heal the world. South Dakota Biotech is here to inform, to connect, and to advocate for our critical industry. Whether you're directly involved in biotechnology or looking to learn more about it, we want to hear from you. Find us at www.sdbio.org. Now, back to the show.
In the world that Diane and I work in, you can have something like an assay that doesn't work. And you can sit down and do a root cause investigation. You can get a team together. You think you identify it. Then you have someone go back down to the lab real quick and run the assay again. And you see what the results are. And then they come back and say, hey, yeah, that fixed it. Or they say, oh, it didn't work again. And then, well, okay, you know, let's dig some more. Let's try these next experiments and we see what happens. But that's quick and it's pretty cheap compared to let's fire off another rocket.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it's pretty crazy to get your head around.
It really is. And there was a lot of institutional will, I believe, to find what the root cause actually was after so much time and after two missions being lost.
Has there been a T-10?
I don't think so. I think that the launch company rebranded the line into another line of rockets. So I don't think there was ever a T-10.
I guess where I was kind of left hanging is, okay, well, how did you get to that actual pinpointing that it came from SAPA, that the issues basically stemmed from SAPA? So I guess maybe we just dive right in there.
If I understand your question right, it was how did we pinpoint SAPA as the supplier for these frangible joints? And the answer is pretty straightforward, because the mechanical drawing of the frangible joint extrusion called out SAPA's plant, which was the Technical Dynamics Aluminum plant, as the sole supplier for these frangible joint extrusions. So without a doubt, that plant manufactured every frangible joint extrusion that this launch company used over probably a 20-year period. So when we found out that the T8 and T9 frangible joints were made in the same plant, but they were also manufactured, they were assembled at the same time, then we became focused on the SAPA plant in Portland, Oregon.
With the MIBs, from when they form to when they end, how long is that process? Is there a usual time window? Is it pretty quick, or does it end up being drawn out? Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I can a little bit. These MIBs, the first one lasted 2 to 3 months, I believe, and just from my memory. And usually the way MIBs work is they convene in one location and they are more or less, I don't want to say sequestered, but they are, they're supposed to remove all other duties from their plate and focus just on solving the MIB. So it's a focused, concerted effort over a fairly short period of time to try and find the answer. So the first MIB convened for, I want to say, 2 to 3 months. And then the second MIB convened for maybe a little longer. But I don't remember off the top of my head how long, but that's generally the way that works.
I love that idea of you have one job, investigate. Because most of the time it's easy to be like, oh yeah, I've got this going on, and I'm doing this investigation and trying to like give it the time and quality attention you need to make that successfully, get the answers you need.
Right.
So kind of going back on the story here, what can you tell us about the process of investigating SAPA?
Okay. Well, I can tell you a little bit. When we first began our investigation, at the IG, what we knew was that on at least a couple of occasions, SAPA had certified that their product met a certain standard for 6061 T6 extruded aluminum, but that the test performed in a NASA lab in fact, showed that this aluminum did not meet that standard, you know, on a couple of occasions from the pieces of aluminum that were tested. So based on this information, that was kind of our starting point. And we then used a subpoena to compel SAPA to give us their internal testing records, which that took some time. And then we also had to review all of those records. And during our review, we found thousands of instances where mechanical properties test results were changed. And our investigation during the same time as the initial review was going on, we also interviewed quite a few people who used to work in the plant. And there were a lot of them that confirmed that the test results were in fact being changed. So our investigation also determined that the changed test results were being used on material certifications that SAPA was giving to its customers, which included the companies that built and assembled the frangible joint extrusions that were used on T8 and T9. In broad strokes, that's kind of how the investigation of SAPA went. But all of that took several years for a lot of reasons.
I guess it's no wonder how maybe previous missions didn't have that same failure with all this going on for a long, long time. I don't know if...
Well, see, that's complicated. And it's interesting because I think T8 and T9 to some degree was kind of like a perfect storm.
Mm.
And there's a margin of error, a safety margin that's built into, that's engineered into most launch systems. And so there were, as I said, there were some other things that eroded the margin to the point where, you know, this discrepant metal was probably the apple that tipped the cart.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's possible that discrepant metal had impacted other flights, but not surpassed the margin of the safety margin, had not eroded the margin to the point where it caused a real problem.
And if I was going to speculate, I would imagine that may have been happening at the same time with SAPA profiles, because they could have started with a good process that eroded itself over time.
Mm-hmm.
And as it eroded, maybe that was what started leading to changed test results, potentially.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Very possible. Very possible. And it doesn't mean, it certainly doesn't mean that everything they produced was bad. There's, you know, on the contrary, there was, you know, there was a lot of the material that they produced that had no problem at all. But it, you know, it doesn't take, it only takes one bad, you know, or one discrepant piece of the metal to cause a problem in the right situation.
Yep. And the same thing when in our world, you don't allow things to go wrong in your process for a drug product that you have going out the door. Because
mm-hmm.
even what may seem minor, if you know it's outside of that safety margin, when you release that out to the general public, there's a huge amount of risk that could go into that. So we have to draw the line as soon as it goes out of that margin,
mm-hmm.
it's not conforming anymore. And it's not going to get out.
Makes total sense. Mm-hmm. And that's, that is quality assurances. They're the gatekeeper to make sure that, that's why in the quality world, it's always interesting to me that one of the terms that's used in the quality world is an escape. Because if a bad, you know, I like to think of it as like a burnt potato chip on the conveyor belt from the, from the I Love Lucy show years ago with, you know, if one of those burnt potato chips gets down the belt, then it's seen as an escape. And quality assurance is supposed to make sure that doesn't happen.
Burnt potato chips.
Can you speculate on why it was hard for the team at NASA to suspect that the certifications from SAPA weren't true?
Sure. That's a great question. The answer, I think, will maybe provide some pretty valuable insight. I guess first of all, mishap investigations boards are comprised mostly of engineers and technical specialists. The process they use is very methodical and logical, and I think MIBs are probably really well suited to find technical causes for really complex failures. But But both boards, in this case, investigated hundreds of different possible scenarios that might have caused these failures. So the way they would work is they would start off and they would brainstorm as many different possible causes for the failure as they could possibly, you know, come up with. And then they would form those into different like fishbone scenarios. And then they would assign teams to investigate each scenario and try to prove it or disprove it. And one of the scenarios that both boards looked at was the possibility that the metal in the extrusions was not up to par, not meeting standard. But when they investigated the scenario, both boards, they took some, you know, the reasonable steps that they would take, and which started with reviewing the paperwork and the documentation, and they found a material certification from the supplier saying, you know, nope, everything is good. We performed some tests. Here's the test results, and so the MIBs basically trusted that certification. They took it at face value, and then they took that scenario off the table as possible causes, and they moved on. Because the way an MIB works is when you start with that many different possible scenarios, the first thing that you want to do is eliminate as many of them as you possibly can. And then you look at what's left, the things that you can't eliminate. So because there was a material certification from the supplier saying everything was good and that the material certification contained test results, the MIBs basically just took that right off the table and they moved on. So I don't think that they ever really consciously considered that fraud may have been involved, because they weren't really trained to think that way. So one of the engineers later explained it to me this way. This guy said, Sapa was the largest aluminum extruder in the world at the time. They had 66 different plants in like 33 different countries. They were a $1 billion corporation. Plus they had an ISO 9000 quality certification. So the thinking was, surely they must be very good at what they do, maybe even the best. Otherwise they wouldn't be so, you know, so large and so successful. So the engineer asked, why would a company like that falsify an order on what was really a relatively inexpensive part? I mean, I think that these frangible joint extrusions cost maybe a few hundred dollars each. So I think there was definitely a false sense of security there. But at the end of the day, the government and also any other consumer has to trust the parts and material certifications that they get when they buy things, unless there's a reason not to. Does that kind of answer your question?
Mm-hmm. It reminds me of a saying that I've heard in the quality space, which is you trust but verify.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So Wade, what has happened to SAPA now? You know, the relationship with NASA especially, I'm assuming that they've gotten out of that relationship.
SAPA no longer exists. Okay. They were acquired by another company. And NASA has excluded them from government contracting for a period of time. Mm-hmm. And they have, my understanding is that they have taken some aggressive steps to fix the problems that they had, and that they've made significant progress.
Good to hear.
So, yeah.
In the biotech and medtech space, we rely on tons of suppliers. It's very normal to have a large supplier list. Mm-hmm. Are there any lessons learned from NASA that in our industry or even small startups could apply?
There's a few. I guess the first one, and the one that I would foot stomp the most and I say this to quality assurance people, regularly, is do site visits on your suppliers. Do supplier audits that include site visits. Doesn't have to be, you know, every year, but you have to do them periodically. This is absolutely critical. In this case, the launch service provider performed no visits, zero, between 1992 and 2011, after the second rocket had crashed. So I can't help but wonder that if there had been, you know, even a few pretty thorough site visits to the Sapa plant where these things were being manufactured, whether or not I can't help but wonder if this activity that was going on might have been, you know, outed years earlier, and maybe these mishaps could have been prevented. Mm-hmm. So number one, do your supplier audits and do site visits. And Aaron, as you just said, you know, you can trust them, you can have a good relationship with them, but when you're doing the site visit and the audit, make them verify their processes and make sure that, you know, they're, if they have quality standards in place and they have a quality manual, like most suppliers and big companies do, make sure they're following it. So that's the best advice I can give you. I have a couple more. Do you guys, does that answer that one? Does that make sense?
It does. Mm-hmm. Yeah, please.
The second one I have is verify and document that your supplier understands your requirements. And this is just, it's just in the interest of being thorough. If you communicate a change to your product, you know, make absolutely sure that the supplier understands what you're changing and why you're changing it, and then document it. And this is just going to make it easier to sort out any problems down the line if you happen to have any. I hope you don't. But if you run into problems later, documentation is key, and it's going to make things go smoother in getting to the bottom of it. And the third one is conduct. It's the one actually that Aaron just mentioned is conduct independent testing on a percentage of the materials, any materials that are going to get used on anything deemed critical, and certainly anything that might pose a health or safety hazard. It would be a really good idea to you know, take a small percentage of the products that you get and just do some independent testing and verify that material certification is good. That could potentially save you a lot of grief down the line. Finally, the last thing that I have is question things that don't look right. You know, and if the answers you get just don't make any sense, you might consider reaching out to your friendly neighborhood inspector general or another investigative agency, especially if you're dealing with something that is a critical product or something that could affect someone's health or safety.
It makes me think about so many procedures I've read on supplier controls and how many companies will basically say, if you have an ISO certification, whether it's 9001 or in my world, medical device 13485, mm-hmm. an audit is not required. And you can basically mm-hmm. just accept their cert as having a valid QMS and everything should be fine. And mm-hmm. we're warned by the FDA, our U.S. Regulatory agency for drugs and medical device, that you shouldn't rely on that alone. And that just, again, validates that.
I would tend to agree with that observation. I think that ISO certifications certainly provide some value across the board, but I would be very hesitant to trust that alone as evidence. In this case, the supplier had an ISO certification for years. During the same time they had the supplier, the ISO certification, they were being audited by ISO, and they were in the process of systemically changing mechanical properties test results. There was even a procedure in place, a written procedure that kind of showed some of their lab technicians how to change it. So ISO certifications are not, they should be used as a tool. One of many things that you, when you look at a supplier, to give you an indication on whether or not it's a good supplier. Mm-hmm. Certainly a valuable tool, but I wouldn't rely solely on that.
So based on kind of your advice here and everything else we've talked about, do you foresee changes at NASA and how suppliers are managed in the future after this investigation?
You know, I guess first of all, NASA OIG doesn't really have the authority or the responsibility to actually make changes on how NASA oversees its suppliers. But our mission is ultimately supposed to help the agency operate as safely and as efficiently as possible. So along those lines, every now and then, we get the opportunity to emphasize the importance of things like supplier quality assurance to big NASA. And the results of this investigation, without a doubt, definitely emphasize the importance of quality to senior NASA leaders. And we've gotten every indication that they heard this message. For example, NASA's Acquisition Integrity Program recently incorporated a T8 and T9 mission failure case study into a block of mandatory training that every single NASA employee has to take every year. So from our standpoint, raising awareness is probably the biggest single thing we can do to prevent problems in the future. In the instance where NASA does implement policy changes or writes better contract language to be inserted into contracts, you still have to depend on contracting officers and program engineers and quality assurance people down in the trenches at the field level to implement those policies and to make sure that they get followed. And so again, I kind of come back to, you know, raising public awareness of those types of things is probably the most important thing that we can do.
This must have felt really good when you were able to finish off this investigation. It's huge. It was a huge undertaking, it sounds like, and probably took you
big impact.
I don't know that you would have ever foreseen where it was going to go when you started on it.
No, I didn't, and it definitely. I've been doing this job for over 30 years now, and this case was definitely one of the most, if not the most, difficult, challenging cases that I've ever had. I worked on it for about 7 years, and there were times when I didn't think that we would ever, you know, figure it out. And you know, but it's like anything. I guess you just take it a day at a time. I guess we started kind of seeing the light at the end of the tunnel around 2015, 2016. I think we, you know, as a group, and there were a lot of people in that group, we started kind of understanding what likely happened. So yeah, but it was definitely an experience. Honestly, not one that I would care to repeat, because it was an awful lot of hard work. As interesting as it was, I think everybody involved put in a lot of grueling hours. So from that standpoint, we're the closure is good.
How would you compare it to those James Bond movies you used to watch?
I don't know. I mean, that was just more. I mean, everyone when they're kids, you know, certain characters capture your imagination, and I certainly never, you know, would have dreamed that I would actually end up working for NASA, even though I was a Star Trek fan. You know, the James Bond, this was a long way from James Bond. I mean, Fall is boring. It really is. And most of the time it maybe looks glamorous from the outside, but most of the time it is going through boxes and it's lots of coffee and late nights. Mm-hmm. So
I can imagine. Mm-hmm. What a great story. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. It was truly my pleasure.
Yeah. Thank you, Wade. With us today, we also have Lindsay Marshall from OmegaQuant. Lindsay, can you tell us about OmegaQuant?
OmegaQuant is an independent analytical laboratory that offers evidence-based nutritional tests to researchers, health practitioners, and consumers with a focus on fatty acids. OmegaQuant offers the Omega-3 Index test, which was co-invented by OmegaQuant's president and founder. The Omega-3 Index test is a measure of EPA and DHA in the blood, specifically in the red blood cell membranes. The omega-3 index is used as a risk factor for heart disease and has been linked to improve heart, brain, eye, and joint health. Our test has been used in more than 200 clinical studies. We have worked with more than 100 international research institutes, including the U.S. Army, NIH, and Harvard. OmegaQuant is located in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and we have operations located in Australia and Scotland, which allows us to provide the omega-3 index globally.
I feel like as I get older, I'm going to need a test.
You can have one. I could have brought all three of you one.
I had one.
Did you?
Yeah, when I went to visit. Yeah, one time. They were very nice enough to give me a little finger prick. I was within range, apparently. So
nice.
No action needed, yeah.
So Lindsay, what is key to delivering high-quality results for your customers?
OmegaQuant is CLIA certified. So CLIA stands for Clinical Laboratory Improvement Amendment. Basically, this means we adhere to established quality standards set for all clinical laboratories. This ensures accuracy, reliability, and timeliness of results. Because we're also a high-complexity test, we have additional quality requirements for personnel qualifications, equipment, test performance, and proficiency testing.
So, Lindsay, this episode is about investigations and how to dig in and find root cause. There are many tools and tips. Are there any that are your favorite?
Yeah. Investigations in the laboratory really range in complexity. So one tip I would have is to keep things simple. The first thing I like to do is go through a quick out-of-specification checklist that looks at variables. Some of these variables are procedures, people, equipment, reagents, and calculations. This can be similar to a fishbone analysis or the 5Ms in manufacturing. My second tip would be never underestimate the impact of a change to a process. Once a root cause is identified, perform a Kappa analysis to properly validate any changes that can be identified to correct or prevent your OOS.
Kappas are Diane's favorite, too, if you didn't know that.
Yeah, I have a sickness. I like Kappas and audits.
I like them, too, if people do them.
Yeah. Yeah.
That does help. So, Lindsay, is there anything else you'd like the listeners to know about OmegaQuant?
Yeah, OmegaQuant has been named to the Inc. 5000 list for the fastest growing companies for the last 2 years. We have been growing exponentially, and we've just expanded our portfolio to include vitamin D testing, which is really exciting to be able to provide both the omega-3 index and vitamin D test to our consumers at home because immune health is so important right now.
Yeah, it definitely is, and it's good to hear you guys are growing.
Absolutely.
We're big fans of the small companies around here, and watching them be successful and get through those early stages is always a good thing. So
yeah,
congratulations.
Yeah. We also have an abundance of information and research on our website, which also includes access to our podcasts, blogs, and newsletters. So if you're interested, you can check them out at omegaquant.com.
Awesome.
So thanks, Lindsay. So this is the part now where Diane and I kind of dive into the main overall story. In this case, it's the SAPA investigation and with NASA and the loss of hundreds of millions of dollars over what ended up being a failure that happened with the supplier. And so, like, my takeaway from that story is there's two key things. One is you need to have a solid supplier management program in place. And there's regulatory requirements for that, at least in the biotech, medical device space. But then also you need a very effective investigation plan or approach. And those tools help you get to the root cause so that if you have a failure, you can eventually get to it, solve it, and prevent it from happening again. So my favorite investigation tool is to go to the site and see what happened. Whenever there's investigations and people don't go to the scene, but just stay in an office and try to listen and talk it through, I feel like you could miss out vital clues that you could get being there in person. Mm-hmm. So if I was going to pick my favorite tool, first one is go to the site or wherever it is that the event happened and begin just looking at stuff.
I used to work for a company that was really big on doing Kaizens. And so they would always stress going to Gemba. And so that's what we always said. We wanted to go visit the site where something happened, where the cause of the issue may have, or even where the issue stemmed. We would just always call it going to Gemba. I love that. I agree.
Yeah. And in the case of the NASA story, it was looking at raw material that would have been on the rocket, some of the scraps that kind of led to understanding there was a problem with the properties of that material, of the aluminum. And that's kind of like going to the site in a way. And then ultimately in their investigation, they did go to the site where that material was manufactured.
Mm-hmm. One of my tips, I suppose, is to get the right team of people involved. I remember Wade, he was, you know, stressing the fact that the team members involved in the investigation are really kind of what got them to the actual cause. You know, just talking about him and his expertise and not really necessarily being the technical person, but having his perspective and his team's perspective on the investigation really made a big difference. So that's another key one for me.
Have you ever done supplier audits, Lindsay?
I have not. I have looked into documentation from certain suppliers that we've deemed critical to look at. And most of our suppliers are regulated under ISO standards. And so I've never gone on site.
You don't need to do them based on risk. So I think there's a risk component that you have to look at. You can end up with so many suppliers that if you try to go into each single one, if there's ways you can just focus on which ones are critical, then that begins to make it more easy. And some businesses may not have a supplier that is critical in that case. So what I found to be completely fascinating with the NASA SAPA case is eventually they get to the site, they go through and look at the data, they determine that there was records being falsified. And in our world, if we did an audit, you would go there, you would see these write-overs occurring, and that there was things being changed.
Mm-hmm.
And our conclusion would be, you guys need data integrity training, you should go retrain yourselves. And we would probably not qualify them as an auditor, as a vendor, and then we would leave.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, it went through prosecution because there is such serious downstream effects of that failure in their quality system.
Mm-hmm. Indeed, yep.
And I don't know that we often think through what the consequences are of those types of failures. And so it'd be easy for us to go to someone and say, you're not approved to be a vendor for us. But in the meanwhile, if they were doing something where they were falsifying records, they could be doing that for other companies and products and jeopardizing their products and mm-hmm. their safety.
Yeah.
So there is a very much broader impact outside of our own businesses. And that's why I think every company should embrace a quality system to prevent those types of things from happening.
From my perspective, I think a lot of companies obviously will use the same supplier, but I think the use of that supplier is for all kinds of things. It's not necessarily for one particular type of device or unit or whatever the case is. And so, like Lindsay said, you know, they maybe are doing some reviews of the suppliers for low risk types of product, or that component that they're receiving from the supplier is relatively low risk for their use. But for another company's use of that supplier, it might be much higher risk. And so I think one mistake that a lot of companies make is they kind of see, you know, different companies are using this supplier, so they must be good. You know, they kind of draw this conclusion because mm-hmm. they have this big customer base. And I think still, you know, I want to emphasize that the expectation is that you're reviewing the supplier for your use, not general use or not for another company's use.
That's a good point. And I would add on that companies are large, and a company like SAPA is very large as well. A component of SAPA having an issue doesn't mean the whole company has an issue.
Right.
It may mean that there's a larger failure in a corporate quality system, but it's very difficult to control the individual actions of people when you're a large organization.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not uncommon to have a really good company that has maybe a site that has a problem, and that problem is what leads to that larger reputation issue, which certainly doesn't give reason to overlook it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it doesn't mean that you just assume all of it's bad. It
right.
means that there's an element that's bad, and hopefully that gets corrected and is no longer an issue.
Yep, absolutely.
Well, I think that's a wrap for this episode. Thank you for listening, and we hope you tune in again.
We hope you enjoyed this episode. This was brought to you thanks to South Dakota Biotech Association. If you have a story you'd like us to explore and share, let us know by visiting www.sdbio.org.
Other resources for quality include the University of South Dakota's Biomedical Engineering Department, where you can find courses on quality systems, regulatory affairs, and medical product development. Also, if you live in the Sioux Falls area, check out Quibit, a local quality assurance professionals network. You can find out more about Quibit by clicking on the link on our website, too. Diane and I would like to thank several people, but a few who stand out are Nate Peppel for his support with audio mixing, Barbara Doral Christian for her support with graphics design and web, and lastly, the support from South Dakota Bio.